talk to you this morning about love, and I want to read you 1 Corinthians 13. And I know you're already annoyed inside because we're not at a wedding. So, and I know you've heard this a million times, and you're like, yada, yada, but I want you to just sit where you are and close your eyes and listen. Maybe try to figure out a way to hear these words in a way that you haven't before. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but don't have love, I'm nothing. If I give away all my possessions, if I hand over my body so that I may boast but don't have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It's not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Is love enough? That's my question. That's been a grounding question for me for the last few years of my life. Is love enough in a nation that's so divided and divisive? It's been my question when I wonder whether my small acts of kindness or my local acts of resistance matter at all, as they can feel like tiny drops in an ocean of injustice. It's been my question as some personal foundations have continued to shift in my own life professionally, and as I've watched my children grow into teenagers, and my husband and I know that we're entering into that final stage of at-home, in-the-nest parenting before we launch them out into this big, wide world. Is love enough? It was my question a few months ago when my foster nephews, who had been with us for almost 2 years, were abruptly returned to their very dangerous home without warning. I asked it this summer as my son and I tutored refugee children in Dallas, of which we have many. And those children are facing seemingly insurmountable odds. This is the question that haunts me when I pray for children who are separated from their parents, or for mothers who are mourning the death of their unarmed sons, one of whom died just last week in my hometown of Dallas. Don't get me wrong, I believe in love. I believe strongly in love. I spent a decade as a pastor and before that as a chaplain, and nobody on this planet can convince me that anything is better than love attending to every kind of problem, heartache, struggle, or pain that I've witnessed. Love is the balm of this universe, and when it applies, it heals wholly and completely and fully. I know that love never fails. But I also know that people do. I do. I'm guessing you do too. And these days, many of our hearts are so tired and worn out. With all this suffering, how far can one person's love stretch? So Paul penned some of the most beautiful and true words about the power of love in his letter to the Corinthians. And while I find them inspiring, these days, they also just feel like a really tall order, which part of me wants to ask Paul if there's like a lowest bar love that I can resort to on those days when I feel really soul zapped. Like, dear Paul, do we have to exhibit Olympic-sized love all the time? Because I'm tired and I just can't today with the love. And yet, I also really know that the world needs all the love power that it can get. If you sit in this quandary long enough, you find that lurking behind that question, is love enough, is another more vulnerable question. Am I enough? Do I have it in me to love suffering strangers enough? Not to mention those in my own city, my own community, my own home. Now, you know, I'm sure if you've read Paul at all, that Paul is not one to hold your hand or mince words, so I'll just skip to the part where he answers. He says quite bluntly that without love, we aren't just not enough. We are nothing. Thanks, Paul. He makes his point by describing this hypothetical version of himself as a kind of spiritual superhero. This hypothetical person could speak in the tongues of both mortals and angels. And as someone who's now a writer full-time, I cannot overemphasize what a superpower this would be, when most days getting out the kind of sentence you'd allow others to read is like a gargantuan feat. This person he's talking about has the intellectual capacity to comprehend all mysteries and all knowledge, which, when you think about it, is the two realms of knowing that cover everything we could possibly human experience. Right? This Pauline superhero could have the kind of faith that moves mountains, whether literal mountains or mountains of metaphorical things like fear or injustice or doubt. But if there were a person with any of these traits, and even all of these traits, Paul boldly declares they are still absolutely nothing without love. Really? Like, someone who gets both all mysteries and all knowledge? Is that seriously nothing? Is he sure? But of course, this is a trick question, and Paul knows it. The tongues of mortals and angels ring hollow without love. Prophetic powers fall flat without love. A faith without love can't move an anthill, much less a mountain. And nobody understands the mystery of this world or the knowledge of this world if they do not experience love as chief among them. Paul tells us that there's love and there's everything else, and without love, the rest is just noise. Which makes me wonder if we approach this passage and our whole gospel from the wrong angle, when we try to make it about our own actions, our own expression of love, our own noisemaking. We think this is a description of what we are supposed to be like, rather than what he is longing for us to experience. I'm reminded when Jesus tells us that the sheep know the voice of the good shepherd. It's one of my favorite stories. They know his voice and they follow him. Other shepherds come, but the sheep have spent so much time with the good shepherd, they aren't fooled, they don't stray. And I wonder if Paul is trying to explain the same kind of thing for us here. He wants us to spend time with real love, to hear its voice so that we know it when we see it and we know it when we don't, so that we follow it when it calls to us. What would the church be like if we had been tuned to the voice of God's love more deeply? What would the world be like if those of us who follow the way of Jesus were faithfully following his example? What if the primary form of discipleship that we taught was the kind that taught us to discern the true love of God and live into that love and follow it at any cost when it calls? I can see why Paul wants to make his case for us to experience this so passionately. It could change the world. Love is patient. Love is kind. It's not arrogant or boastful or rude. It doesn't insist on having its own way. It isn't irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing, but in the truth. Love, that power Paul longs for us to experience and to know, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Yet as beautiful a definition of love as Paul gives us, there is in fact a simpler and more complete one, right? Love is God, and God is love. That's the mystery and the knowledge of it. We may be distracted by the noise, but God's love has always been the song. It's the tune of the universe echoing over us in perfect harmony, in full tonal resonance, a symphony of salvation, love. And friends, here is a mystery cracked wide open. Before we can learn to live as love, we must learn to live in love. Before we can do the loving action or speak a loving word, we must first learn to reside in the arms of love. This is what I talked about last night. I call it original blessing. You can call it whatever you want. It's the act of choosing first and foremost, before we do anything else, to reside in the love that God has for us. and to allow that place to be the wellspring from which all of our action and intention grows. We must learn this song and let God sing it over us until its tune is like our very breath, our own heartbeat. Like sheep who follow the Good Shepherd, we are to know love's voice, to experience it, and to feel it. And when we begin to know it and trust in it, we begin to realize that love is always available. This can be a mind-blowing realization, because so often we're duped into thinking that love is far from us, unreachable, especially in those times when its presence is needed the most, like when we feel lonely or depressed or unworthy, or when someone is pushing our hot buttons until all the fire alarms are going off, or when someone at work is being particularly difficult, or when your toddler or teenager is throwing an epic tantrum. We think love may well, in those moments, be located on a faraway planet. Which is why, if I would be so bold as to add one thing to Paul's letter, I would say, love is always present. The trick, the real feat, is taking a moment to remember that when a gong is clanging in your eardrums. Love is here, and it's available to us. Before love is an action on our part, it is a gift on God's part. It's a holy and sacred gift, one that is freely offered in endless supply by God. It is as near to us as our very breath. So what if we see these verses not only as a description of human love, which it is, but also as a description and reminder of God's love, which from the first pages of Scripture to the very last reveal a God who is open and willing to bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, and endure all things, even when that thing is the death of God upon a cross. For if Easter teaches us anything, it is that love is enough. It's more powerful than hate, more powerful than political machinations, more powerful than institutional religious hypocrisy, more powerful than human doubt and rejection by Peter and others, more powerful than violence, more powerful than empires, more powerful than death and all the demons therein. Love is an expansive and expanding force. I love the description of the Trinity as this God who is in three persons, so filled with love that creation was its natural and inevitable overflow. The fancy word for this in theological circles is perichoresis, which actually means dance. And I love this image of the Father, Son, and Spirit dancing together in joy, delighting in each other so fully that joy spilled out into the creation of the universe and everything in it. God couldn't just sit around in community just enjoying one another in this mutual love. It is an experience, a force that God needed and wanted to share. And what really boggles the mind about this is how we are then invited to share that love back to God, both directly and in the way that we love each other. That this love force activates us and animates us. Love is the soil in which all goodness and righteousness and justice and mercy and kindness and wholeness grows. I think of this every Advent season when I contemplate how brave God was to send the Messiah as a baby. Do you think about how crazy that is? Think about this. Jesus didn't stumble into his power by accident. God put that baby in a home filled with love and devotion. That baby had astrologers come from halfway across the known world to show him love. He had a mother and father who for 2 years sheltered him in Egypt away from that corrupt and violent Herod because of the fierceness of their love. And we can only surmise that all those Sabbaths in the temple and all that prayer in his home cemented Jesus in the love of Abba, Father, until he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and humans. And only then, after all that love, was Jesus able to speak in the tongues of mortals and angels. and fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and display prophetic powers, and give all he had, even his very life, because he had the kind of faith that moved not only mountains, but the gates of hell. His was a life grounded and anchored and saturated in love. And had that not been true, he would not have been our Savior. Jesus shows us the way of life, the way of love, because he has walked it before us and he has received it from us. And also because he received that love at the hands of humans who remained close to their source. So it comes down to this. For the salvation of the world, it comes down to this. Live in love, and you will live out love. I should say, it gets disastrous when we get this out of order. If we try to live out love without first living in love, it feels impossible and exhausting. And we begin to wonder whether love is enough. If we long to sing the song of love God has echoed over the universe, we first have to put our symbols down and rest in it, trust in it, and believe in it, even when the nightly news screams anything but love. The simple truth is that without this love, we are indeed nothing. Our very breath is a gift of love from the Creator who breathed life into us. This world would crumble to pieces if the power of love didn't hold it together. And when we feel that the cracks and broken places are threatening us, the only thing there is for us to do, the only thing available for us to do, is to return to the arms of love, to hold tight and refuse to let go, because we trust that the love of God is the most stable, stabilizing, healing, and harmonizing force in the universe, and it hasn't once let us go. When we stay close to those arms, when we return daily, hourly as necessary, because Lord knows it is a dumpster fire on my Twitter feed, only then, in the arms of love, from the seat of love, from a place where we are filled up with love, can we tap into that place within ourselves that is capable of mirroring God's love and sending it out to others, like flickers and glimmers of love's truest song. Not perfectly, probably also not consistently, but we dare not doubt for one second that it can be beautifully. And now, friends, in 2018 America, more than anything, we need that love. For our own survival, for our own sanity, for our own flourishing. And the world needs more than anything for that love to become embodied in us. Even imperfectly, even incompletely, even momentarily, the world is desperate for this love. It's parched. Is love enough? That's been my grounding question these last few years. Because it invites me to remember this wondrous mystery, that love is actually available at every single moment, as much as needed. I ask myself, is love enough? Because when I doubt, I know that the most important thing I can do is return to the place where I remember that love is present to me. What I feel in that moment as lack becomes, upon reflection, a reminder of fullness. As I pray through the headlines or hold close beloved friends and family who are suffering, as I scan the horizon of history at what could be considered unsolvable, impenetrable problems, it only takes a moment to recenter in the one place where fear becomes possibility, where trepidation becomes action, where doubt becomes courage. Is love enough? It's a clarion call to come home, to let the love of God gather us up and cover us like a mother hen with her chicks, and speak over us this one divine word filled with every bit of God's goodness and glory. Yes. Yes, child. My love is enough. My prayer for us is that we may rest in that love, that we may trust in that love, and that we may live in that love. One of the reasons that we come to the table as people of faith, and when we remember that this table has been ours for 2,000 years and counting, and that even this Sunday morning as we gather, there are people all over our country and beyond in the global world who are gathering around this same table saying these same things about this same person. And one of the reasons that we come to this table so consistently is because we need to feast on Christ's love. We need to remember that this is the kind of love that's enough. It's a suffering love and an offering love, but it's also a healing and fulfilling love that brings the salvation of all things. If we are to leave this place this morning as God's people in the world, we do so because we feast on the love that is given and that we remind each other of here in this place. So I'm reminded that on the night that Jesus took bread with his friends and even his betrayer, he took the bread and he just gave thanks for it, for the earth that made it, for the people that created it. He gave thanks. And he broke this bread and said, "My friends, this is my body given for you. When you eat this, remember me." And after supper was over, we know that he took the cup of wine and gave thanks over it for the grapes that produced it, for the people who created it. And he said, "My friends, this is my blood poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Whenever you drink this, remember me." And as we come to this table again and again, we are reminded that in remembering Christ in his love, we choose to live in it. Not in our fear, not in our anxiety, not in our imperfection, not in our depression or frustration, not in our anger, but in his love. So friends, this is the feast of God for the people of God. May we come forward and remember that love is indeed enough.